The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Back. It's Monday. Another Monday. It'll be Friday soon enough. I think these weeks go by in about 2.5 days now. Hell, I think the year's gone by in 6 months or less. It's over. One more week and we're into December. Crazy. I do hope everyone out there, wherever you are, even if you don't live in these formerly United States, if you're at all realistic about life and living and etc., every day should be a Thanksgiving. Always bless each day is a gift now. And wherever you are, I hope you do have a special time with your family as much as you can this Thursday. All right. Donald Jeffries is with us tonight, but he's got double trouble tonight. Not only is Don here to unload on us, but he brought along this man he met under a freeway overpass. Or something like that.
Guy says he was a show business legend back in the day. I don't know. I say he was Frank Sinatra's writer. I don't know, but he's a great guy. I love him. You know, we fell in love with each other. So.
Yeah. And his name is officially John Barber for all of you out there. John, are you there? Oh, uh-oh. He's not there. Oh, John. I wonder if John forgot.
I don't think so. I just posted it on social media about an hour ago, and he liked it.
Hang on, I'm working on it.
We're working on it.
He liked it instantly. So yeah, I know he's usually early for these things, as you know. John Barber's he is so prompt; it's unbelievable.
Todd's trying to get him now. He might have forgotten. Who knows? If he's home, we'll get him.
Yeah, well, no,
what do you do in Las Vegas at 6 o'clock at night except be home and have dinner? It's too early to go out clubbing.
He might be picking up a big check at Maggiano's. That's one of his favorite things. He likes to, you know, he loves to. He's a if you go out with him, he's going to pick up the check. So I guarantee you that. So.
And it'll be Italian food most likely, right?
Yeah, Maggiano's. Yeah, that'll be Italian food. Yeah, and he'll make a recommendation what you should order, and you know that's what he does. So that's it. There he is.
Yes.
How are you?
Okay.
Tell him how you are, Don. Tell him how
John,
you are.
I'm fine. We were joking because he thought you were there, and he said, I brought along a guest with you, some guy you met under the freeway. And I said, yeah, it's this guy who said he was a show business legend and Frank Sinatra's writer. We hit it off. We fell in love with each other right away. So that was my my little introduction to you.
Oh, my God. I thought maybe you guys should... forgotten all about me. I was just sending you a note. Are you and Jeff's already? I mean, it's 10 after 6, so I thought maybe Jeff thought I was going to be on Friday again. So
No. We're good. You're all right. No problem. Now what? Here's the deal. You went to Los Angeles, or your film, the premiere of the film.
It's on the 22nd, 2 days from now.
It's coming up in 2 days. But didn't you go down earlier for some other reason to set it all up or something? Anyhow.
No. What I've been doing, I've been just doing scores and scores of interviews. And the reason that I called you a couple of weeks ago is because rather than waiting till the fourth Friday, which is when I usually come on, I wanted to get on 2 days before the opening of the film.
That's right. It's this Wednesday, the 22nd.
Yep. Yes. And then on the 25th, which is Saturday, my son, who's the co-executive producer of Criminal Minds, and my wife want to give me a Christmas present. So they're sending me down Saturday to spend the whole day for all three screenings, 1 o'clock, 3:30, and then 7:30. And so I'll be down there to meet and greet, maybe do a Q&A or whatever it is. But there are a couple of reasons that I wanted to be on with Donald is because Donald made a major, major contribution to the third and final film, which is John Barber's and William Shakespeare's Last Word on the Murder of JFK. And then, of course, I spent a great deal of time with him 5 years ago when our second film came out, when we were at the press club together. And of course, he wrote the most brilliant introduction to My Mother's Not a Virgin. But usually you ask me, and I'll get around to the business of this wonderful thing that Donald did. Usually you ask me how are things in Las Vegas.
Well, you're getting a professional baseball team. I guess things are looking up a little bit. All you need is an NBA team and you'll have one of everything.
Well, the thing is that today and for the last 3 days, I've been totally housebound. And the reason...
What was that? House broken? What?
No, housebound.
Just there a little joke, almost, John.
There are almost 250,000 people in town for what they call the Las Vegas Formula One Grand Prix. $250,000. You know what Grand Prix means? And that's a French word, French expression.
Well, you know, soft on the X. I got it.
Okay. Do you know what it means in English?
I can guess, something but big. Let's have John's interpretation. Go
Very
ahead.
Effing expensive.
Oh yes, I'm sure.
It's a lot of local news with lawsuits. Okay, and they may not have gotten around the country.
I posted it. I got it. I posted it Thursday. Okay. Yes.
Some people they're paying $10,000 and $5,000 to sit in mediocre seats to watch cars go around in a circle, even in rehearsals, okay? And some of them are being removed by the cops. And they show them the stubs, and the cops don't care. So they're being sued. Now, here you have these lunatic Americans sitting in these seats, just watching cars go around and around and around. Now, you'd think they're hoping to watch them cross the finish line. No, they want to watch them crash before they hit the finish line.
Well, that's the big secret with Grand Prix racing. People really want to see action.
And so the truth is, Jeff and Donald, if I want to watch car crashes, I have the greatest second story house. And I could go out on the porch just above Rainbow Boulevard and get out my binoculars. And I could see 15 crashes in 2 hours. I'm telling you, I could probably get some of these people to give me, I could get a dozen to give me $500 to come up on my balcony and give them binoculars and watch those crashes. I mean, they'd have a field day. Oh, my God, honey, look at that truck. It just squashed that Mini Cooper. Isn't that great? Oh, and then we got to watch the ambulances come, too. I mean, it's really cuckoo. You know, it's like Bill Hicks said about, he said he would have more fun watching homing pigeons tie their legs and watch them trying to land. So and then I'll just say this last thing about Las Vegas. Frank Sinatra.
There's never going to be a last thing about Las Vegas, John.
Well, no. There might be. You know, it'll be, It'll say, abandon, no water. That's the thing. Turn out the lights before you leave Las Vegas. Okay. Yeah, but Sinatra has this great song, Chicago, and he calls it My Kind of Town. Well, he has a song called This Town. And I don't know if you two guys have ever heard it. It's a very negative town about a no-good town. And Jilly, who was Sinatra's best friend and his bodyguard and a very dear friend of mine and my Sarita's when we were in Toluca Lake in California, he said he was really talking about Las Vegas. So there you go. He mentioned it, though.
So, really? Now, so wait. Now, don't lose me here. So Chicago was really about Las Vegas?
No, Chicago was called My Kind of Town.
Yeah.
He loved Chicago. Okay, that's where he met Sam Giancana and all his buddies, okay?
All those, yes.
But
all the PhDs. Mm-hmm.
Yes, all the PhDs. So, but there's another song, very successful, and Google it. It's just called This Town. And some of the lyrics are, is a no good town? Okay, that's one of the lyrics. And Jilly said, he's never mentioned the name of it, but he was talking about Las Vegas.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
So you get a little insight. And then about Sinatra, two things. As Donald Jeffries played, as I said when I sat down, a very major role in helping me put together the finished film, John Barber's and William Shakespeare's Last Word on the Murder of JFK. So, Donald, you want me to tell them how you did that?
Sure. Go ahead, please. Sing my praises, John. You know I always love that.
Okay, there you go. The very first draft of the film that Stu Shostak edited magnificently. The very first, right? And the idea of the film is that it tells two stories at the first at the same time. One of the stories is my 53 years of trying to tell Jim Garrison's story on television for the primary purpose of raising $1 million so that I could set up a law scholarship in his name at Tulane University. And the second part of the film is telling my story at the same time I'm trying to survive in this very tough cutthroat business, which fortunately I did very, very successfully, and becoming a new citizen, a new father, and a great husband to the greatest wife anybody ever had, because there would have never been a real people without Sarita. Now, in the film, the first third of the film, I wanted it to be like a three-act monologue, a one-man show, and the first major part of it was about the America that used to be, the America that I wanted to come to, and the America that's no longer here. And
boy, that you got that right. It's gone.
It is gone. And fortunately for me and Sarita, we lived through the golden age of politics when John Kennedy was president, of movies from 1939 until the middle 70s, 1939 being the greatest year for American movies. And of course, the golden years of television. You could never get All in the Family on the air now. You could never get the Golden Girls
on the air now.
You could never get Sanford and Son on the air now. So we lived through the golden years. So anyway, in my 90 lucky years, I have only had one real disappointment. And then, of course, that would be the middle part of the monologue. And then the last part of the monologue would be when I went to England in 1960, when I was 20 years of age, to track down my father, which I did, and to go to William Shakespeare's birthplace, because when Jim Garrison and I often talked off camera, we often talked about his favorite author, who was Shakespeare. And if you look at his book, Heritage of Stone, all the chapter headings are right out of Shakespeare. So in the middle, when I first did the first draft of the film, I spoke at length about a woman who just with a stroke of the pen could have written $1 million check to give Jim Garrison a scholarship at Tulane University. She is a billionaireess, all inherited, and Donald knows her very, very well. And we were and are still very closest of friends, but she did not do it. And then Donald looked at it. My son said, "You know, Dad, that's an interesting story, but that's for another show. You have elevated her to a position. This young lady I'm talking about became my fan because shortly after her husband died, she had nobody to turn to but me. Even though she's very Catholic, she didn't want to turn to a priest because her mother and father took her down when she was 10 to meet Oliver Stone in Dallas. So not only did she watch his film a number of times, but she became a lawyer. So she wanted to grow up and prosecute and electrocute or hang the murderers of John Kennedy. And the only other person she came across with that passion about Jim was myself. And of course, it was Jim who chose me to be his Boswell over Oliver Stone. So when her husband died, she called me, we became friends. But my son said, "Dad, that's a really, really interesting story, but you've elevated her to a place I don't think she deserves in the film as your major disappointment." So now I called Donald after he sees it. And Donald, though so smart and so to the point, he says to me, I'll just say her first initial is M. He says to me, "Well, you know, John, you were in show business all your life, okay? And Frank Sinatra was your greatest friend for 4.5 years. You were his private writer and almost his best friend for 4.5 years. So what is the greatest disappointment, really? Not having our lady friend write this large check or Jim Garrison's a scholarship? Or the fact that through some really quirk of fate, you lost your friendship at the end with Frank Sinatra?" And there was no question that that, to me, was a not much greater loss. So I cut out about the 12 minutes of telling the story of this magnificent woman. I mean, what a genius she was, for God's sake. But she had no place in the film. And instead, I insert 3 minutes is all it took to tell the magnificent story of how I met Frank Sinatra, how he became his private writer. And at the end of this show, I got something out of the archives that Francis had me write for him that he loved. And it's about falling in love. And when I close with you guys, it's not that I don't want to push the film or anything like that. We'll do that during the bottom of the show. But I want to end with a very, very positive up note for all of you. So with the guidance of Donald and his suggestion, we redid it. And I must tell you, the 7 people who have seen it absolutely loved it. And then my son, of course, who was the co-executive producer of the executive of Criminal Minds, and now, thank God, that strike is over, the actor's strike is over. He said to me, and he's seen everything, he said it's one of the greatest endings of a film or a documentary that he's ever seen. He said he and his wife and his in-laws absolutely stood and applauded and cheered what I did at the end.
A masterstroke.
What I did at the end with Hamlet's most famous soliloquy. So there we are. So okay, now, Donald, what would you like to? Where would you like to take us in this conversation?
John, hold on. Right there. Just pause. I want to make sure everybody knows, everyone who's listening in the Los Angeles area or who's going to be there, the film opens the 22nd, Wednesday. You're going to be down there Saturday for all three showings to meet and greet, mix and mingle, and all of that. So if they want to see it on Wednesday, you need to give us a little direction here. How do people who are down there line themselves up to go see it on Wednesday on its premiere?
It's at the Town Center 5 Theater in Encino, and I think that's 17,200 Encino, and there are three screenings at 1 o'clock.
Ventura Boulevard, 17,200 Ventura Boulevard. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. So, oh, my God, I still wish you lived in Santa Barbara. I told you last time we talked, I would drag you down there and take you to the greatest restaurant. Mm-hmm. Musso Franks, and then I would take you to one of the screenings of the film. So
wow.
I'm really curious myself to see it on a large screen. I mean,
they're going to have to lift you out of your seat. It's going to be quite an experience.
I'm sorry I was late in sending you your own private copy, and maybe you haven't gotten around to looking at it yet.
No, I'm waiting on that. I didn't want to look before the premiere. I'll get to it, though.
I
have to do something on Thanksgiving.
Oh, well, there you go. Anyway, so that's that. And there's a lot more that I could say about Mr. Garrison, as could Donald. But Donald, you have any thoughts? You saw the film.
Yes.
Your thoughts on the film?
Well, you know, John, I'm your I'm very prejudiced because I'm your biggest fan. So, you know, anything you do, my wife loved it too. She loves watching it too. You know, you're mesmerizing. I've heard a lot of the stuff before because I've, you know, pretty much seen and heard everything you've done in the last, I don't know how long we've known each other, 5, 6, 7 years, and we've done so many of these shows together too. So I'm very familiar with your story. But it is, it's compelling. In some ways it is. I called your, you know, as you like to refer to in the foreword I wrote for your book, which I was incredibly honored to do. Although Jeff, I was a little worried because he finally got to me after all his celebrity friends had died that he wanted to write it. I mean, you know, he went like one by one, they were dropping like flies. And Tim Conway couldn't do it. He wasn't dead yet. But I said, and John said, you sure you want to do it? And I said, yeah, of course. So I tempted fate and did it. But in the foreword, I referred to his story is very much like David Copperfield. You know, I think is the greatest novel ever written. I think Dickens is the greatest novelist. And I think that was his finest moment. I think it's the finest moment in English literature. And there's an element of that in John's story. It's like David Copperfield goes to Hollywood. And so he's got a compelling story on his own. And then, of course, when you throw in the JFK assassination stuff, which, you know, obviously is where that's the wavelength we met on, because we had that in common. And, you know, again, when I was watching Real People all those years ago, I really didn't suspect that. I really didn't know that about John. The internet wasn't around then, so I didn't know he was working with Jim Garrison. He was, you know, kind of in the same world I was, because I was already at that time. I guess I was through with Mark Lane's group by that time, but still, I was reading everything I could devour on it, subscribing to Penn Jones, The Continuing Inquiry, which is the Bible for assassination research back then. But I had no idea that this guy that hosted the show that my wife loved and her sister loved and that I loved, you know, was into this movement. And that's why when I suggested about Sinatra, because it was very sad, you know, because his friendship ended with Sinatra over something connected to that in a way, because it was, if I have it right, he basically, it was because John was, wasn't it John? Wasn't it because of the what you wanted to do with Noguchi? You were trying to save Thomas Noguchi's job?
Yes, I was trying to save Thomas Noguchi's job. And again, I got involved with Jim Garrison quite by accident, okay? I mean, when I was talking to Red Fox, who was my lifelong mentor, and I may have mentioned this to you before, Jeff, and I was calling him a hero, you know?
Right.
And Red Fox said, "Heroes ain't born. They're cornered."
Oh, that's funny.
So, yeah.
That's very witty.
Yeah, it is. And it's so truthful. And I said it to Mr. Garrison, and he really howled because he said, John, it is true, because I was cornered by accidentally running into Congressman Hale Boggs. He said, you know, I believed in America, and I believed in authority. Shame on me, but I did. I said I wanted to be a lawyer, so I ended up in the FBI. Where else? Jimmy Stewart starring in that movie, FBI. I wanted to be that. He said, I wanted to be in the Air Force, you know, seeing Spencer Tracy flying over Tokyo and dropping bombs. And he said it wasn't. And then he ended up in Dachau. He was one of the first people there to liberate Dachau. And that's the only picture that's in his office, is him sitting by a barbed wire fence, and written underneath is, lest we forget. But he said he's on a plane with Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs was the only dissenting member of the Warren Commission, and they would not publish his dissent. So Hale Boggs is really pissed, and he's on the plane with Garrison, so he starts to blurb. He said, Jim, you know I'm 100 in a couple of months. I'm going up to Alaska and shoot me some big grizzly. Okay? He said, but I seen that Dago rifle and that crooked sight there. Now, I'm telling you, that kid couldn't shoot a dead rabbit. And Garrison says, you mean? That's all he had to say. And he said, yes, I mean. So Jim went out and bought 26 volumes of the Warren Report. He put one in the car, he put one in the office, and one at home. And the reason that he was looking at Lee Harvey Oswald is because that's his jurisdiction. So the first person he wants to arrest, of course, is David Ferry, the pilot who in a rainstorm goes to a Galveston to an ice rink, starts making phone calls about arranging flights. And, of course, he dies and he leaves two suicide notes. And so Garrison, with his great sense of humor, said, well, I better arrest Clay Shaw now before we find two or three more suicide notes. Now, this is how decent a man, a great attorney he was. It's in the second film, The American Media. You see all this deviant, homosexual, sadomasochistic paraphernalia brought out of Clay Shaw's house. Now, Clay Shaw at the time is known as this very prominent socialite. He's like vice president at Permandex or someplace like that.
Yes.
He buys homes and redesigns them. Very famous and applauded businessman in New Orleans. Now, one of the accidental memos or files released by the CIA, and we're going to get to the business of the files in a minute. And they were, the Records Assassination Act was passed in the late 90s because of Oliver Stone's brilliant film. And they were supposed to release 6 or 7 years ago when Trump was president, and he caved in and never released them. And now we have Joe Biden last week saying on camera, I am washing my hands of this and leaving it up to the CIA. And then the CIA announces, we are never opening the files, 1 week ago. Now, this is, they're telling this mainly to Jefferson Morley. Well, when Trump was president, Jefferson Morley was trying to get the Garrison files and never the CIA files. The CIA files are supposed to be released in the year 2037. You don't get Garrison's for another 25 years. Now they are never, ever, ever going to be released. So he takes it all the way through the courts up to the principal court in Washington, D.C. about 6 years ago. And then the judge, after hearing the arguments for and against the release of the files, not CIA files, Jim Garrison files, this judge rules against Jefferson Morley and in favor of the CIA. And guess who the judge was? Tell him, Donald.
Oh, the judge just, I don't know. I don't know.
It was Brett Kavanaugh.
Oh, that's right. That's right, Kavanaugh. Yes, and right. Now, that was a while back. Yes, Kavanaugh.
Trump appoints this guy to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I mean, how rigged is this? Anyway, this is how terrific Jim Garrison was. When he arrests Shaw and all this homosexual stuff there, he orders his staff, you do not say a word to any of the press, because that has nothing to do with his handling of Lee Harvey Oswald being a CIA handler, has nothing to do with the conspiracy case, so you're going to be quiet. So they never uttered it. And the reason was this. He had a slam dunk perjury case, which I will get to right now. What they do is the CIA accidentally released a file in our second film, and it says if we don't get legal help to Clay Shaw, Jim Garrison is going to win the conspiracy case. Well, not only did they send legal help, they sent 8 infiltrators, all named and identified in the second film, who were stealing his stuff. I mean, wow. Lou Ibons, who was his second chief investigator, said the biggest threat to our case is Jim himself, because he believes all these strangers who want to come to help. Now, get this. He loses the conspiracy case because in those days, if you're talking about the CIA to American normal human beings, they think you're talking James Bond stuff. What is that? It's so alien. But Garrison gets 10 years of his tax records, and he almost won, but didn't quite get it. But in 8 minutes, he got the perjury conviction because Clay Shaw said he never saw Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby or David Ferry when they had 87 witnesses who saw Clay Shaw with Lee Harvey Oswald. But get the other witnesses that were going to blow the case out of the water. He had 3 20-year-old gay homosexuals. All of them signed affidavits saying they all got $20 a piece for having male sex with Clay Shaw, Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, and Perry Raymond Russo, who was Jim Garrison's chief witness. And then they had a professor from Illinois who lived for 1 year with Clay Shaw, and then Clay Shaw at the end of the year threw him out. And you know why? He got a transgender operation, and Clay Shaw didn't want to be living with a woman.
That's pretty crazy stuff, John.
Listen to the last one. He has a guy who's offered $25,000 to literally shoot Jim Garrison. And he thinks about it because his daughter is about to die from an incurable disease. And they promise him, not only doctors in America, the best in the world. And he thought and thought about it, and he went crying to Mr. Garrison, a grown man, to confess. He said, you want to know something, Mr. Garrison? I think the loss of John Kennedy means more to the world than the loss of my daughter. Oh, my God, what a thing to say. Okay. Wow. So now Garrison had all of this stuff. So he knew if he got Clay Shaw on the stand, it would be like a bad Perry Mason episode. Where he sees these gay guys about to be witnesses against him, he's going to jump up and say, I'm guilty. I'm guilty of perjury. I did know Clay Shaw. I did know all of these people. I, you know, all of it. And then he knew he had a slam dunk case. But guess what? So did the government know it. And they stepped in and stopped that prosecution. Jim Garrison arrested Clay Shaw in 1969, and I'm a street kid, and it's 2 years they're calling him a kook and an egomaniac and a nut and all of that, and I lost the Friends as a street kid, saying, if that guy has nothing, let him go into a courtroom and fall on his ass, for God's sake. They stopped him every way they could until January 29th, 1969, the day my son was born. And he would have won that case if the government had not sabotaged him. Now, John Kennedy is dead, and he is gone. And to me, as cruel as this sounds, he is not as important as Jim Garrison. The only one worth remembering is Jim Garrison. And if John Kennedy were alive and Thomas Jefferson were alive, who were the idols of John Kennedy, was the idol of John, they would agree, because Jim Garrison is the only district attorney in 100 years who stood up against the president of the United States, about the Senate, against the Congress, against the media, to try to prove that no one in this country should be above the law, which is, you all know now, is the biggest crock of shit ever dumped on the American people. It would overflow the Grand Canyon.
Absolutely. John, I want to jump in this thing, say, because John has that's kind of an opening to my brand new book that I wrote with William Law. John contributed to it as well. We have Bill Davey wrote the foreword, and Ed Haslam, who wrote Dr. Mary's Monkey, wrote the preface. It's called Pipe the Bimbo in Red, Dean Andrews, Jim Garrison, and the Conspiracy to Kill JFK. And it goes into my friendship. Actually, my brother, my late brother's, was best friends with Dean Andrews III, the son of, the New Orleans beatnik lawyer, was played by, and that's where the title Pipe the Bimbo in Red comes from, Oliver Stone's JFK. John Candy says that, playing Dean Andrews at one point as a woman walks by. But we go over a lot of these things John's talking about, and we look at what I call the ground level plot in New Orleans, and that's what Garrison was. Garrison was exposing the ground level plot, and Shaw was important because Shaw was the only one, I think, all those guys. I mean, Garrison believed, and I think he was exactly right, that Oswald was an undercover agent for either the FBI or the CIA, maybe both. At the time of the assassination, he was on assignment and told to infiltrate a plot to kill the president. And that's what got him mixed up with all the anti-Castro Cubans and Ferry. And
also, Donald, that there were three patsies in Dallas, as there were multiple patsies in Chicago.
Yes, Chicago, too.
In Miami and there. And one of them was a guy named Richard K. Snagel.
Yes,
who worked both for the CIA and for Russian intelligence. And Donald was exactly right when Jim Garrison said that Lee Harvey Oswald was assigned to infiltrate this group and report back. And also assigned to do the same was Richard K. Snagel. Yeah. So Richard K. Snagel is discovering the same things that Oswald is discovering, that there is some kind of a plot going on here. So, now, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald doesn't say much about it at all. I think he wrote something to Hostie, an FBI agent who tore it all up.
Yes.
But Nagel was a lot more nervous. So he sent registered letters to the CIA and the FBI and said that there's something really going on here. And they hung him out to dry. And he thought, my God, I'm going to be the next patsy. So he goes to Texas, and he pulls out his revolver, and he walks into a bank, and he empties it into the ceiling. Yeah. And the cops come and arrest him. And, well, you're not robbing a bank. What are you doing? He said, I don't want to be in Dallas on November 22nd. Now, Nagel thinks he's only going to get a few months for what he did. They sent them to 10 years in the psychiatric division of a Missouri prison.
Yeah, exactly. And they did these kinds of things to so many people. One of the people, for instance, that saw one of the fake impersonators, Lee Harvey Oswald, Ralph Leon Yates, he spent the rest of his years in a mental institution because he thought he was nuts. And there's so many more people like that. But in our book, we found, for instance, that the Garrison's investigators were working on. Most people know about Sylvia Odio and the firing range and Albert Bogard, the guy driving the car, Oswald, you know, saying maybe I'll go to Russia where they pay workers enough to buy a car, the fake Oswald. But they had fake Oswalds in New Orleans as well, doing the exact same thing. He was being impersonated everywhere. This was such a huge operation. And the thing that was great about Clay Shaw in terms of Garrison getting him, if he could have gotten him, I think Shaw was the only one of that group. I think Jack Ruby, I think David Ferry, Jack Martin, all the anti-Castro Cubans, Guy Bannister, I think they all may have been manipulated against each other. They, for all I know, they may have all been told by their handlers, "Hey, you infiltrate this plot." And it was a really ingenious idea. And so they're all reporting back, and they have no idea. They might not even have known Oswald was going to be the patsy.
You brought up Clay Shaw, so let's get back to Clay.
Yeah,
Shaw.
Yeah.
I want to point out something that could have absolutely ended this case on January 29th, 1969. Jim Garrison he went to a grand jury. The grand jury heard all of his evidence. They heard all of the defense from Diamond, who happened to be the name of the lawyer, Clay Shaw, who was in our film. And they said, "You may bring this to court." But Mr. Garrison wanted to protect. It's not his case. He was looking to defend the rights of Clay Shaw as an American. So what he does, he gathers three of the leading judges in Louisiana. And he goes before these judges, and Diamond shows up with the 26 volumes of the Warren Report to try to prove that his client, Clay Shaw, is not guilty in any way of being involved with the assassination. But, of course, Clay Shaw is not even mentioned in the Warren Report. And the three judges say, not one page of this 26th volume is admissible as evidence because none of it is an investigation. 26 volumes of total hearsay. So we're throwing it all out. Now, if the New York Times and the Washington Post or Huntley and Brinkley or Rather and Cronkite had told the truth about what happened with that being hearsay, there would be 18 skeletons hanging today from lampposts in Washington, D.C. for the murder of John Kennedy.
Oh, there'd be a half a busload or a whole busload, you bet.
Exactly.
You know, John, hold on.
Yeah.
John Barber, without John Barber, very few people would know much about Jim Garrison now at all. And I think that needs to be pointed out.
Oh, I got to tell you something quick. And then, oh, my God, today, you know, I'm a hockey junkie, right? So I figure,
Golden Knights.
No, not now. It's still the L.A. Kings. But close. They're second. I wanted to see where the Kings were playing tonight, so I turned on my TV about 4 o'clock, and I have no picture. So I call Cox, and I get this young voice talking to me with a very foreign accent. And I identified myself, and I said, "Listen, two or three times since you gave me this new box, I'm not getting a picture." So he spent about 35 or 40 minutes, and he's very, very, very patient. And finally, he gets it, and he said, "Thank you, Mr. Barbu." That's what he called him. "Mr. Barbu, you know, you've been with us 20 years and you joined Cox the day I was born." And I said, hold a minute. "You're 20 years of age?" And he said, "Yes, sir." And I said, "How do you learn this stuff?" He said, "Well, I grew up with it, so I know it." And I said, "Hold it a second. Where are you living?" And he said, "In Manila, in the Philippines." I said, "I figured, you know, every time I call you people, and from anywhere in America, I'm trying to get something fixed."
Outsourcing, yeah.
Yeah, they never live in America. So he started to giggle. And he said, "Before I say goodbye, could I ask you a question? Because we're not allowed to talk to our customers." I said, "Well, you're talking to me or fixing my TV set?" He said, could I ask you a question? I said, yes. He said, will you answer me? Well, I'll either yes or no. So answer the question. I got to go. So I said, I got to do a show. Oh, he said, I know, then you must be. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you do show. And I said, yeah. Are you the John Barbu? I said, what are you talking about? The one who do JFK and John Garrison movie.
Wow.
And I said, are you kidding me? And he said, I'm your biggest fan in the Philippines. Oh, my God. Would you believe that? Oh,
okay. Wow.
Isn't that staggering?
That's incredible.
Yeah, no, I was just listening to John. You know, his mind is like a steel trap. Doesn't miss a thing. You would have been a hell of a lawyer, John. You would have had the jury laughing and on your side in 2 minutes. And then you would have shredded. You would have shredded the opposition.
Oh, well, that's very sweet of you. As a matter of fact, it was probably one of the first things I ever wanted to be. But and some people. Oh, yeah.
We have 5 minutes left, gentlemen, just so you know. 5 minutes.
I have to tell you a story. Oh, 5 minutes?
Yeah. Yes,
okay.
Please.
I wanted to tell you the story about Jim Garrison's character and his marrying his ex-wife on his deathbed.
Yes, that's incredible.
Because when she divorced him, he gave her almost all of his $2 million. She lost it with somebody else. On his deathbed, he called her back, and he remarried her. And she wondered why she was even there. It's a very humor exchange, which I don't get into. But anyway, he said, I am now a very successful judge. And when I go, you are going to, because her husband, new husband, has spent everything. When I go, you're going to live on that. And when he died, she got that pension. There you go. Okay.
Yeah, that's a very big man that does that. But before we run out of time, I just want to point out that the 60th anniversary is coming up in 2 days of the JFK assassination. So John's film is coming out right at that time, and my book along with William Law, I co-wrote with William Law, is coming out at the same time. But neither one of us are invited to these confabs. They don't invite us, so we're making our own contributions here.
Okay. Do you want to hear what Frank Sinatra had me write for him for life about love?
Yeah.
Or you want me to hear bitch about the fact that Rob Reiner is now doing Spotify, a whole 10-part series on Jimmy.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to hear? The love or the whining by me?
I want to hear Rob Reiner because I still want to see it because I can't believe CNN is recommending it. It can't be telling the truth, but who knows? Maybe Meathead is telling the truth.
Okay. So here is a little bit of whining because I'm getting an awful lot of notes about it. I mean, you heard of the Bob Dylan song that he wrote a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Why wasn't he writing it 50 years ago? They are all heroes after the fact. Listen, when I first put Muhammad Ali on the air, only two people would have put him on the air, Jack Parr and then Howard Cosell. And they wanted him all dead because he wouldn't follow LBJ's advice and go over and kill yellow people when he thought white people were the threat. Everybody's a hero after the fact, okay? Well, listen. Rob Reiner is a great actor, wonderful director. He is 50 years too goddamn late. You cannot tell about the murder of John Kennedy unless you're telling Jim Garrison's story. And you cannot tell Jim Garrison's story unless you're telling the story of the Boswell that he chose over Oliver Stone to tell his story in the two definitive films of the murder of John Kennedy and the solved and sabotage case of Jim Garrison's investigation. And nobody has called yours truly.
I know what you mean. I mean, I'm going to be, I think I have 4 interviews on the 22nd, a podcast, you know, the podcast would love me, but the conferences have no interest in me, just like they don't have any interest in you. And it's sad because I look at some of the people that are speaking there and it's ridiculous.
It's a disgrace. November 22nd is the day America died. That's how I look at it.
And as, listen, you know, when you have Hamlet reading a book and somebody's saying, what are you reading? He said, words, words, words. Well, listen, I like Cyril Wecht a lot. I don't like Judith Baker at all. She's a waste of time. All 50 years of whimpering, for God's sake, when Garrison already proved Oswald's innocence when he arrested Clay Shaw in 1969. All of these people are words, 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 and they are absolutely worthless. They are, if you can't walk the talk, you're crippled. Right. And they're all intellectually crippled. They are all moral and physical cowards who are living off of. You want to know something? It reminds me of a routine Lenny Bruce did about if Jerry Lewis's muscular, if they found a cure for muscular dystrophy, okay, Jerry Lewis would go broke. If this case were open, where it's a cold case at the Justice Department, and it's solved, and all these other people arrested and all of the rest of it, these people have no life. Yeah. Still have a life. Donald still has a life. These people will have none.
I agree.
Good to put it, John. You should be the dean of the community. I've said that many times, and it's absolutely. But there, it's that's why I don't try to do much there. And Douglas Caddy's been very supportive of me, the former Watergate lawyer. I think he'll post about our book on the. I'll try to get him to talk about your film on there too, John, to post it on there. But nobody else. These people are full of their own egos, and most of them haven't even written a book, or certainly not put out any documentaries, and they're just commenting on forums and. They dominate the so-called research community. And as John said, I mean, this was solved. I mean, you know, Oswald was proven innocent before Garrison. I mean, Garrison, you know, nabbed the guy that he could, Clay Shaw. And I think Clay Shaw is really important because I think he was the connection between those ground level plotters, which were all being manipulated like Oswald and really weren't conspirators, although they all hated Kennedy and would have been conspirators. With the exception of Oswald, he's the only one that had a positive opinion of Kennedy. And Shaw was the connection between those guys and the higher ups, whoever they were.
I'll never forget the one little clip of Oswald saying, I didn't kill anybody or something like that.
It's too bad we don't have another hour because I can tell you some insights about, oh, my God. The second in command of intelligence in Vietnam, what he told me about the Bay of Pigs. I guess we don't have time.
I don't know where you're going to be Friday on the 24th, probably in transit, but you still have that hour available if you want to pop in and do that Friday evening.
I would be so worn out. But the next I'd love to do another show again with the three of us, you know.
We'll do it.
Sure.
Okay. Again, right. thank you so much, Donald. Because if you improved the film 1,000%, believe me.
Wow.
Well, that's true. Really if they nice. Give you some kind of an award, just mention me on stage and I'll be happy.
I was just really
glad to hear in the beginning when John told us he'd finally housebroken. That's a big step. Anyhow, listen, congratulations in advance. I hope it goes just swimmingly well. I don't know how it can't. Have a wonderful time. Happy Thanksgiving. Give Sarita a hug. And Don, we will talk to you soon. And have a great time, John.
Happy
just really enjoy every moment of it.
And I can't wait for you to see the film, Jeff.
I will. I'm looking forward to it. I really am. All right. Okay, good night, gentlemen.
Good night. Happy Thanksgiving to both.
Happy Thanksgiving. You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Well, what an achievement. I've been holding this film in reserve for a special time. I'm going to look at it on Thanksgiving. All right. We'll be right back with more.